Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. We continue our evening series in Luke's Gospel. Now, Jesus has arrived in Jerusalem. He's arrived at the very heart of the nation. And as we saw last week, he's forcing a division. Between who? Between those who truly are the people of God and those who say they are and are not. Because not all Israel by birth are Israel in heart. And so with the cross only days away, Jesus is forcing the people to confront that great question upon which all our destinies hang. Who is this Jesus? And the clearer the answer to this question, that here is the Messiah King, here is the beloved Son, the greater the confrontation with the Jewish authorities. The plainer it becomes that here is the Lord's Christ, the greater the hostility of the religious leadership. And it's now reached such a pitch that they want him dead. Verse 19, and the chief priests and the scribes that very hour sought to lay hands on him. Here on paper are the most God-fearing people in all the world. But they have murder on their minds. So please have chapter 20 and verses, particularly verses 20 to 26, open in front of you. What we'll do is we'll open up the passage and then we'll simply draw two lessons. So verse 19, the chief priests and the scribes are out to get Jesus, but they've got a problem. What? The people. Chapter 19, verse 47, we're told he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the leaders of the people sought to destroy him and were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. And again, verse 19 of chapter 20, the chief priests and the scribes at very hour sought to lay hands on him, but they feared the people. If they move against Jesus openly, publicly, then these religious leaders will discredit themselves. If they take Jesus by force, they'll have a riot on their hands. So what do? Adopt a new strategy. Verse 20, so they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authority of the governor. They're watching. They're waiting to catch him. They send spies to spy on him. Do you see their plan? By infiltrating the crowd with their own people and pretending to be wide-eyed and enthusiastic hearers of the word of God, they can entice Jesus into saying something incriminating. After all, if Jesus feels he's amongst friends, his guard will be down. And with a bit of flattery, we can lull him into saying something he shouldn't. And then all we have to do is put the right question to his lips and stand back and wait. But what sort of question? Well, get him to say something anti-Rome, anti-Caesar. And all we have to do is to tell the governor that there's a preacher of sedition. He's in the temple. He's stirring up the Jewish people to rebel. And the Romans will do the rest and we'll come out of this squeaky clean. Brilliant. Or so they think. Anyone here not seen the film, The Great Escape? Do I need to remind you of the plot or what it's all about? It's a film about the greatest breakout of Allied prisoners of war in the Second World War. And if you've seen it, you may remember one of the last scenes. There's Richard Attenborough and Gordon Jackson, and they're boarding a bus, maybe to freedom. And there's a Gestapo officer checking everyone's papers. And having checked Jackson's papers, he hands them back. And he says to him, in English, good luck. And it's a friendly voice. It's a voice from home. And in that moment, his guard is down. And he turns to the Gestapo officer and says, thanks. And you know, oh, the game's up. He's incriminated himself. Now they'll get him. So you can see what the chief priests and scribes are up to. If we can catch him off guard, if we can make him feel that he's amongst his friends, he can speak freely, everyone's on his side, then we can get Jesus to incriminate himself. That's the strategy. Let's witness the drama unfold. Verse 21. Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly, and you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the way of God in truth. Did you hear that? The words are very disarming, aren't they? Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly. Oh, if anyone can teach us the truth, it's you. And their words are flattering. You don't show personal favoritism. You're not like the other teachers. Oh, they're afraid of what they might say. But you show no personal favoritism. You're not afraid to tell anyone how it is. And their words appear to be so trusting, don't they? And you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the way of God in truth. Yes, if anyone can teach us the way of God, if anyone can let us into the mind of God so that we know what God thinks on this subject, it's you. And if you're a bystander, listening into what these men are saying, you think, oh boy, these guys are really keen. Now the question itself, verse 22, is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And if you're out to catch someone, it's a very clever question, isn't it? First of all, the question makes room for only two answers. Yes or no. So if you start waffling or being evasive, they're going to bring you back and say, well, yes or no. And if Jesus says yes, it's right to pay these unpopular taxes to the occupying Romans, to these foreign overlords, what do you think the people are going to think? Jesus will be discredited with the people. Doesn't the God of Israel want us to be free and not subject to these Gentiles, these Romans? Isn't our loyalty to God and his law, not to Caesar? Yes or no? And of course, if Jesus says no, it's wrong to pay taxes to Caesar. Your loyalty to the true king absolves you from loyalty to this king. Jesus will be arrested by the Romans, because such talk is treasonous and punishable by death. So yes or no? And you see, it's not a private interview, is it? It's a very public question. There are hundreds of people there to witness the answer. Whichever answer he gives, he's either in trouble with the people or he's in trouble with the Romans. Get out of that. Yes or no? Because it's all framed with such goodwill, such warmth, such friendliness, and Jesus may unwittingly fall into the trap. Some years ago, I went, I think it was, to the Wembley Arena. And there was a Mormon prophet. He was in town. And he wasn't just speaking to the Mormon faithful. Here, as they saw it, was the word of the Lord for all and any who wanted to hear. And the people had turned up in their hundreds, maybe their thousands. Now, of course, this prophet wasn't giving us the word of the Lord. He's a false prophet. And we weren't there to listen to this false prophet. Certainly not. But we were there to speak to the people who were in the snaking queue, waiting to go in to listen to what this man had to say. Well, what do we speak to the people about? Well, we spoke to them about the true prophet, the one who truly is the revealer of God, Jesus Christ. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Well, there we were, and we were speaking to people in this queue, and some of them were just interested. They had questions. They wanted to know is there a way to God? What is the truth? How can I know what God thinks? They weren't Mormons. They were just wanting to know what the truth was. Could they find it? And so there we were talking to people about Jesus and his cross and the forgiveness of sins and life everlasting. Well, as we were talking to people in this queue, two young men came up to me. And one of them said to me, you're a born-again Christian, aren't you? I'm really interested in what you have to say. How did you become a Christian? Could you tell me? How did you become a Christian? Tell me what you think about Jesus. Well, I was thrilled. Wonderful. There's someone who's coming to me and wants me to tell them how I became a Christian. And so I began to talk to my apparently eager listeners. I gave them my testimony. But as I looked round, and there were several of us who went there, I began to notice that my friends who were with me, they were also being engaged in similar conversations by two young men. And then I looked at the badges which these young men had on. And written on them was the Church of the Latter-day Saints, Mormons, and it had Elder so-and-so. Did you see what they were doing? By their apparent eagerness and goodwill, I'd fallen into the trap of speaking to them and not speaking to the very people that we come to speak to, those who are in the queue. The unsuspecting public who were going in to hear this false prophet. Do you see a little interest, a little enthusiasm, and you get drawn in? It goes a long way. How easy it is to fall into the trap of people who are out to flatter you and people who appear to be friendly, and you're drawn in. How easily it's done. You don't give it a second thought. Such eager hearers. They want to hear. What of Jesus? Does Jesus fall into this trap that's been so carefully laid? That's been so apparently brilliantly executed? Verse 23. But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, why do you test me? All the deception, the cunning, the spying, the well-laid plans, the impossible question. Jesus sees straight through it all. It's a wonderful verse in a Psalm 18, verse 26. It says, with the devious, you will show yourself shrewd. Here are these devious men. Jesus is already one step ahead of them. But he perceived their craftiness. They needn't have bothered. Jesus always sees behind the mask, doesn't he? But he's still got to answer the question. Yes or no? Verse 24. Show me a denarius. It's a silver coin. It's equivalent to a day's wages. It's dramatic stuff, this, isn't it, if you think about it? If you look around at the crowd, now every eye is upon Jesus. In the drama of the situation, you get the sense of everyone's holding their breath. You look at the questioners. They don't look quite so confident now, do they? Show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription does it have? They answered and said, Caesar's. He said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. It's a wonderful answer, isn't it? The wisdom is breathtaking. Do you use Caesar's money? Yes. Then you acknowledge that you're under Caesar's government. Yes. And therefore, Caesar has legitimate claims upon you. Yes. Does Caesar's government bring benefits? Peace, order, prosperity? Yes. So if you enjoy the benefits of Caesar's government, should you not render to Caesar his due? Yes. After all, how are the benefits to be paid for unless you pay your taxes? So don't just take the benefits and escape the burdens. Pay to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. I mean, Jesus said all that just in one line, hasn't he? But says Jesus, I see another image before me. It's not a coin that's stamped with the image of Caesar. I see before me men and women, and maybe there are boys and girls there in that crowd too. And they are stamped with the image of God. And if Caesar has legitimate claims upon you, God's claims upon you are absolute. He's the King of Kings. He's the maker of all things. He gives to all life, breath, everything. In him, says Paul, we live and move and have our being. So give to God his due, which is your life, your soul, your all. So says Jesus, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Now look around you. Can you see the smiles on the faces of that crowd? And they're thinking, no one's ever spoken like this man. This answer's extraordinary. This matchless wisdom. This is breathtaking. This is a story they'll be telling their children. And can you see the look of amazement on the faces of the spies? Verse 26, But they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer and kept silence. They're absolutely confounded, aren't they? We had him, didn't we? We gave him a choice, yes or no. And whichever answer he gives, he incriminates himself. He's either in trouble with the Romans or he's in trouble with the people. And there seems to be no way out of our question. But neither has happened. And there's no comeback. How did he do it? And they're startled into silence, aren't they? And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, once again we're confronted with this great question, which Luke has been driving on down through these chapters in his gospel. It's that great question upon which all our destinies hang. And you've got to answer it. You've got to face it. Who is this Jesus? Well, let's now draw our two lessons. Lesson number one, or application number one, very simply, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. We had a second reading, didn't we? Romans chapter 13. And the Apostle Paul puts rendering to Caesar the things of Caesar's like this. He says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. And those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil." You see what Paul says? He says all authority is from God. He's the King of Kings. But does God keep that authority to himself? No, God delegates that authority. He gives that authority away. He gives it to men so they can rule. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And in that sense, Caesar, whoever governs, whoever rules, is God's minister, God's servant. How then am I to respond to government? Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. How do you respond to government? Well, you're to render to Caesar things that are Caesar's. Don't resist government. Says Paul, you submit, you obey Caesar. Has God placed you in a relationship with the state? Yes. Are you a citizen of this country? Yes. Is the state responsible for my welfare? Yes, to an extent. Then says God's word, where it is responsible for your welfare, that responsibility clothes the state with authority over me. And Paul goes on, verse 5, therefore you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. Obey Caesar, not because if you don't, you'll be in trouble, but obey Caesar because conscience demands it, because that is pleasing to God. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Does the state care for my welfare? Yes, to a measure. Health, defense, transport, education. Then the state has the right to levy taxes, to pay for those things. And says the apostle, I am not to begrudge the paying of those taxes. For they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Render to Caesar things that are Caesar's. I am to submit to the state. I am also therefore to respect all who speak in the name of the state or act in the name of the state. Whether that's Her Majesty, the Queen. Also includes Tony Blair, the Prime Minister. It includes all the various arms of the state and all secondary authorities. Whether it's the London Mayor, Ken Livingstone. London Borough of Richmond upon Thames. Traffic wardens. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Okay, well that's, you may think that's fair enough, okay, not very exciting. But what happens when Caesar is no longer content with that? What happens when Caesar starts behaving like God and starts laying claim to those things that belong to God? What then? I was born an Englishman. I used to think, and by and large I suppose I still do, but I used to think this was a free country. English common law said I was free to do whatever was not expressly forbidden. And common law was there not just to protect me from the criminals, but it was there to protect me from an overbearing state. So the state didn't give me human rights. On the contrary, the power of the state was limited only to those areas where it could exercise legitimate authority and no further. So I was free. And the state had no freedom to meddle in my family, my personal affairs, or in church life. And since much of the legislation in this country was established on biblical principles of liberty and justice, the state punished evil and rewarded good. It was, by and large, God's minister to you for good. Benjamin Disraeli summed it up like this. He said, "To the liberalism they profess, I prefer the liberties we enjoy. To the rights of man, the rights of Englishmen." He could just have easily said, "We render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." But things in this country are changing. Caesar is no longer content with the things that are his. Caesar is saying, "I want more." And he doesn't like the beliefs and convictions of some of his people, because they have a higher loyalty, a loyalty that trumps their loyalty to him. They have a loyalty to God. And Caesar is starting to behave like God. He's starting to lay claim to those things that alone belong to God. And actually, he does it by saying there is no God. Do you see? There's a new state-sponsored religion. It's called secularism. It says only what you see and touch matters. It says there is no God. Certainly there's no God in public life. And this new state-sponsored religion is aggressive, it's intolerant, and it discriminates against people of Christian belief because they get in the way. They won't give to Caesar the things that are God's. And so the law is being used to police the beliefs and convictions of some of the most law-abiding and conscientious members of society. The latest manifestation was the sexual orientation regulations, which were published last Wednesday, which seek to force Christians to actively condone and promote sexual practices which are contrary to God's word. And they have no right to refuse to do that, says the law. Your conscience, says Caesar, is bound to me, not to God. Your conscience does what I say, says Caesar, not what God says. So Caesar is starting to say, give me my own and give me God's. And he's starting to exercise power where he has no authority. And that's a tyranny by any other name. And what happens in a society where God is rejected? And since there's no alternative, Caesar starts to appoint himself in God's place. Well, you start to turn the moral universe on its head. Instead of order, you get anarchy. And if you reject God's law, there's no alternative good to put in its place. So you get lawlessness. And instead of justice, you get partiality, where some before the law are more equal than others. And in the chaos and the confusion, those who do good fear the law is going to punish them, and those who do evil get away with it. And the strong oppress the weak, and the innocent are afraid. And ultimately, if it goes on, the whole system collapses. There's a psalm which speaks to those in authority. And it says that where those in authority, it says, they do not know, they do not understand, they walk about in darkness. And when those in authority don't know, don't understand, are in darkness, what does it say? All the foundations of the earth are unstable. You get a society which is inherently unstable and starting to collapse. And in the resulting disorder, people long and crave for order, which is often restored by the emergence of new gods, like Stalin, Hitler, Mao. This country is taking a very dangerous path. Not long after Jesus spoke these words, Caesar began to say that he is God. And Caesar is Lord soon became the religion which united the Roman Empire. The worship of Caesar was the glue which held all these different nations and peoples together. And everyone was happy to buy into that, to say Caesar is Lord, except for one group. Who? The Christians. Those who said Jesus is Lord. Or were they intimidated into silence? No. Were they guilty of treason? Well, it was Caesar who was usurping God's authority. And so within a generation or so of Jesus' words, Christians were being martyred in their tens of thousands because there was no place for them in this new order, this new world. But you see, Christians having been conquered by Jesus Christ, having looked into the face of the Son of God, what a mere man, even if he is Caesar. Well, Christian friend, I'm not being alarmist, but those days may be with us again. It's less than 200 years ago that evangelical Christians were discriminated against in this country. Less than 200 years ago, Christians were kept out of the public life of this nation. You only have to go back a few generations before that and find that Christians were put to death, were imprisoned for their faith. Because they said, I'll give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but what belongs to God belongs to God. It's a Sunday evening, isn't it? It's warm in here. We're drifting. But that day may come very soon when we'll all be going in our Bibles to this passage. It'll make a great difference to hear the voice of the Son of God who says, you render to God what's God's. Don't let Caesar take what isn't his, but render to Caesar what is his for my glory. And to our second application. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Render to God the things that are God's. My friend, where did you come from? Who made you? Who gave you your unique identity? There's no one else in the world like you, is there? And you know it. You have what we call a self-awareness. So who gave you that? Who gave you that sense of you? Yet my budgie looks in the mirror and thinks it sees another budgie on the other side. You look in the mirror and you know that's you. Who gives you that sense of awareness? I can show you a school photograph and you'll say, that's me. Where did it come from? Who gave you a mind that thinks, that reasons, and I'm appealing to that reason now? Who gave you a heart upon which are written values? We can talk about right and wrong, and you understand that. We can talk about good and evil, and you understand that. And who put eternity in your heart? So you think about tomorrow, and what lies beyond tomorrow, and what lies beyond the grave. Who gave you eyes to see, and a voice that sings, and hands that can do good? And who gave you friends, and family, and a home, and that lovely word, belonging? And who gave you another day of life today? Why did you wake up this morning? There are plenty of people all over the world who never woke up this morning. They went to bed last night. They're dead today. Where have they gone? But you've been given another day of life. Who gave you all these things? And the Bible's answer to that is God. You live under God's government. He is the King. All that you have, everything, save your sin, comes from God. And yet as we say that, The truth is, I don't know the one who made me. I sometimes wonder, is there anyone out there? I don't know. Sometimes I don't even know who I am, or what I'm doing with my life. I do think, so often that point, often when I ask questions, comes about the answer, why? What? What's the point? And I do know what's right, don't I? But I don't choose it. I know what's good, but I choose what's bad. And I do think about death and what lies beyond, and it scares me. And there is an emptiness in me that nothing seems to fill. And yes, I have eyes, but I seem to be blind to God. And I have a voice, but I never sing of His glory. And I have these hands, but they don't go around doing good. And I do belong, and yet always inside me that sense that I'm disconnected from something, someone. And what are those who are closest to me? They're often the ones I hurt the most. Another day of life that God has given me? I haven't spent it for God. I've spent it on me. So if I do live under God's government, do I render to God the things that are God's? If God has given to me everything I have, do I give it back to God? Do I? Do I live for His glory, for His pleasure? Is everything for Him? Honestly? Can I say that? And the truth is, I'm far from God. The truth is, I'm a rebel. I live as though God is dead. Says the Bible, I've walked out on Him. In the language of Scripture, I've sinned. And like all those who are guilty of treason, there's a penalty to pay. Says the Bible, the wages of sin is death. Eternal punishment in that other place. Do I render to God the things that are God's? Honestly, do I? No. I'm therefore walking a path upon which God's anger is to be found. How then can I put things right? Can Caesar help me? But all the parliaments that ever sat and all the kings that ever ruled, they cannot change my heart. They cannot give me peace with God. No sin-loving, God-rejecting rebel can be legislated into the kingdom of God. But what Caesar cannot do, God in Jesus Christ does. This is the king who went to a cross. Is that what kings do? Die for their people? Surely people die for their king. But this is the king who died for his people. He's the king of love. And upon that cross, the sins of countless people who've offended God, they were put to Jesus' account, so that when God came to punish the guilty, it was Jesus who took the blame. So that anyone, whoever, even you, if you come to Jesus, you'll enjoy peace with God. Will you come? Will you? Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. If you're honest with yourself, and if you're honest before God, I've never for a moment rendered to God what I should. Lord, I've never given you the love of my heart. I've never given you the worship of my life. I've never loved you, obeyed you, served you, lived for you. Never, not for a moment. And I therefore have nothing to recommend myself to you. But I fall on your kind arms. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And if you come, He'll wash you clean. He'll give you a new heart that beats for Him, loves His commands, loves His ways, loves His people. He'll give you a new life. And having conquered you in His love, it'll be no hard thing, no miserable tax to render to God your life, your soul, your all.